Tell me, turn around, that I'm on it for the moment. But you love me. You know how I get when I'm lonely. I think about you in the moments. But everything you do is so Oakland, so Oakland. Foot on the gas, I'm just trying to pass all the red lights and the stop signs. I'm ready to go. Before I get to the baby, that's a problem. Cause I'm way too scared to call and you might give me a stay night.
I'm Brock Winstead. Welcome to the Eastern Shore. Today on the show, a conversation about where to put your giant metal lady. So I've interviewed artists on this show before, artists working in all kinds of different media, different forms. And one of the topics I like to get into with artists of all kinds is how they find space for their art and how that search for space is changing as real estate prices rise in Oakland, in the Bay Area generally. A lot of us who live here in the Bay Area, if someone asked us to list the virtues of this place, somewhere in that list, we'd say something about culture and art. Any one of us might be more or less eloquent about what that means, but we all be getting at the same thing. We'd be saying, essentially, one of the things I like about living in the Bay Area is all the vibrant artistic creation that happens here and how that contributes to the quality of our lives. We like to talk about the arts, and some of us maybe even support artists in some form or fashion, but as our economy heats up and real estate gets more expensive, that doesn't mean we're actually doing a good job, collectively, of preserving spaces for those artists that we say we love so much. So this search for artistic space is one thing if you need a room where you can, say, put paint on a canvas. But what if you need space to make metal sculptures that are 40 feet tall and weigh 9 or 10 tons? How do you find space for that? That's a question that my guest today can answer. Karen Cusolito is an artist working in Oakland. She studied at the Rhode Island School of Design and the Massachusetts College of Art and worked in the Boston area for a while before she moved to San Francisco in 1996, has been in the Bay Area ever since, almost 20 years now. Her art has taken many forms, from painting and mixed media to the large-scale steel structures that she's developing now and has been for about a decade now. Much of her work focuses on humanity and the environment and the balance between the two. Since 2009, Karen has, in addition to making her own art, Karen has been running American Steel Studios in West Oakland, which we're going to talk about now. Karen Cusolito, welcome to the Eastern Shore.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I have only been to American Steel Studios once, and that was for the inauguration party thing for the new mayor earlier this year. But I don't think while I was there I got a really good sense of everything that was on there on a regular basis, or even the full extent of the place. So help me understand this place a bit more. Describe American Steel Studios.
It's a challenge to do that because it changes dramatically from time to time and without much notice. It's always noisy. It's a 24-hour-a-day facility where people can come in and build things, break things, put them back together, experiment, and just try out ideas that have been in the back of their brains for a while, or, you know, go like gangbusters with a whole crew of people building a big art installation or architectural piece.
How much space are you? Do you find yourself being in charge of?
We measure that in acres. It's a 6-acre building, essentially 4 city blocks, and it's 2 separate but adjacent warehouses. So we have the large industrial portion of the building, which is the bigger part of it, and then there's a smaller adjacent warehouse where we have more of the fine arts happening.
How long have you had space there?
I started there in 2005 for a very short time, just for one project, and then moved out again.
How'd you find it?
Someone I knew, there was one tenant there that had a piece of equipment that I needed to use. So I brought my steel over and he rolled a pipe for me. And that was in 2004. So when in 2005 I needed a space that would be slightly bigger than the 30-foot tall sculpture I was about to build, I recalled the American Steel Building and the large clearance and bridge cranes and all the things that you need to make, you know, 10-ton sculptures.
So you got into the business of making these gigantic sculptures before you really had a space suitable for making them?
As humans do, you grow to fill the capacity of whatever vessel you're in.
Yeah.
So when I suddenly had the ability to go bigger, I did. Prior to that, I was working on, I'd say, kind of a moderate scale. And prior to that, in a smaller studio space, making really more intimate personal size sculptures.
So you showed up at American Steel Studios before. Was this before the whole place was devoted to artist space?
Yes. The building was primarily empty. There were 2 tenants, one at either side of the building, taking up a very small footprint. And at that time, you could see from one exterior wall to the other wall, 2 city blocks away, unimpeded. There was nothing there.
You got some space there because you needed a place to work at a large scale. How did you end up taking on the whole site?
I don't remember making that decision, and I wonder often if it was the right thing to do.
In a fugue state?
I think it was optimism. Essentially, I then leased, say, maybe a quarter of the big industrial building and sublet to other artists, and that seemed manageable. But to really make the changes that were needed in the building to better support what we were doing, it was important that I actually got control over the whole property to do better power distribution, make it more functional and kind of divisible. In other words, different types of activities happening in different parts of the building.
And you have leased the whole thing now. You've sort of had the master lease, I guess, mm-hmm. since 2009. So how many people have studio space or workspace of any kind there now?
I think I have about 145 unique leases, excuse me, and some of those are small businesses with employees. Some are collectives of artists, so it would be a group of 20 or so people. We have jewelry designers, fashion designers, furniture designers, the large-scale industrial artists as well, and painting, a lot of painters, some photographers. We have a spice importing company who also does cooking classes. And some are just, you know, scientists and geeks that are trying out some new interesting things with environmental conservation or energy conservation.
So you've got about 145 individual tenants since 6 years now that you've had the master lease. Are you seeing or have you seen a kind of uptick in demand for the space over that time?
I have. I mean, we're almost at capacity right now, which is not something we've reached before. In fact, my property manager, Sally, is telling me it's time that I need to get rid of some of my toys to make room for other people.
So let's talk about your toys. What do you have? How much space do you have personally?
My workspace varies depending on the size of the project. So it's a couple of thousand square feet, but I also have an inventory of materials that I use, which is also a couple thousand square feet. That's what I'm trying to diminish to get more functional space out there.
I know you as the woman who makes the big steel sculptures, but tell me more about what you actually do and sort of what techniques you use, what form that takes, and some of the toys that you have to make it.
Okay. Well, I'm in an interesting place right now. I'm actually trying to make smaller art, which is actually quite difficult for me. So I use primarily MIG welders, and I have an inventory of scrap metal, very carefully selected, unique historic pieces of old buildings or old bridges or things that I find on the street.
Other than finding it on the street, how do you get this stuff?
There are auctions and scrap yards and know, people are getting rid of old equipment now instead of fixing it. So there are a lot of gears and bearings and parts and pieces of those that are fun to play with. So it's really just looking at what's around you and envisioning it becoming something else.
Again, I know you as the woman who makes the giant steel sculptures, and you have been doing that for a decade and some now. But you're moving now toward smaller what? Smaller metal work?
Yes. I challenged myself recently to make a sculpture that will fit in the back of my tiny little Toyota pickup truck. And I failed.
How much did you fail by? Are we talking like it needed to be half the size?
Wide load permit is what I needed for that. So that was an epic fail. But I'm making art now that is intended to create an intimate space for people. So a place where folks can kind of get together and sit inside of the art. They can talk, they can make out, they can just kind of be in a piece of art that's in a landscape and have kind of a unique vantage point on the landscape as a voyeur or an insect on a leaf or something that's part of the landscape.
How did you get into metal work and metal sculpture in the first place?
It was really just kind of a lark. I graduated art school, and the first thing I did was get a certification in structural welding, and I really never thought I would be building bridges or buildings or anything like that, but it really changed the way I look at things. The concept of throwing things away changed for me. The concept of something being broken changed for me. And the concept of scale started to change because you can go much bigger when you're working with steel. I draw better than I can speak, probably. It's a very natural form of communication for me. Mm. And when I realized I could sketch with steel and really capture a three-dimensional concept very quickly, it really opened a door for me as to what... how far I could push an idea before I actually went through the pain of going there.
You talked about realizing that you could sketch with metal.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
So the first time I tried to sculpt the human form with steel, making an organic form out of stone or marble or steel is challenging. And I remember standing there looking at the materials I'd gathered to start this process and... suddenly was terrified and wondered what the heck I thought I was doing because I didn't know how to do this. I don't know how to capture the soft, fleshy form of human anatomy in something like steel. And I'd never done it before. I had really no idea what I was undertaking. And it became important for me to ultimately sketch what I was about to construct. So once an armature is built, so that's the skeleton, it's made out of structural pipe, I needed to kind of just study that and stare at it for a long time and start to find the parts and pieces of the body and where they were. And I needed to sort of capture that or kind of memorialize where things were. And the best way to do that, of course, is to sketch, which in three dimensions is really hard unless I just found this type of wire that I can use, which allows me with my bare hands to bend this rod around in the shapes and contours that I can start using to really flesh out the form and the stretching where the muscles are taut and where they're not. So that really does simplify the thought process and allows me to get more quickly into seeing what it is I'm building.
I associate you with Burning Man. Some of your work has wound up there, but not exclusively there. So when did you start going?
I think my first year was 97.
Okay, so you sort of got here and immediately plugged into that community.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like for a while you found the desert was a good canvas for you in a sense.
It's an amazing canvas. The only thing you really have to grapple with out there is gravity. There's no boundary otherwise. Like the desert itself is quite flat, so you're starting with a perfectly level surface, and it's amazing. There's a magical quality of light that happens, so the photographs that you can take at just the right time of day are stunning.
Hmm. Did you immediately, 97, you start going, did you immediately start having stuff, building things, putting them out there on the plyo?
I did. It was comical. I really didn't know what I was doing about, you know, transporting art. Working in that environment is really challenging, and I'd say the first two projects I tried to do out there failed miserably, but I learned a lot.
What does it look like when a project like that fails?
I had a piece that was intended to have a kinetic portion that was solar powered. I didn't realize how damaging the alkali playa is to batteries and to electronics, and it never worked. It looked fine, static, but it wasn't really, that wasn't what it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
When something fails, it sometimes is something just the artist notices and others still appreciate what it is.
Yeah. Are you still going to Burning Man every year? Is that still a good home for you and your work?
I have gone every year. I haven't always brought work there. I often will work on other people's projects. And for me, it's just a great family reunion. A lot of my peers, friends, and you know, people that I admire doing amazing work are there. So it's a fabulous trade show for artists in a way.
And I don't mean to pigeonhole you as someone who just does work for Burning Man. Where are some other places that some of your work either is now or has been?
Well, 7 sculptures that were built for Burning Man now are permanently installed on a rainforest preserve in Brazil. Mm-hmm. So that installation had a very strong environmental message to it. So the fact that it's at a place now where they're replanting the forest is really quite poetic.
How did it get to Brazil?
That was... wow. So these sculptures range in size up to about 30 feet in height and up to about 11 tons in weight. So they were each laid down and a steel crib was built underneath them with lift eyes on it so that the crane could just hook to the crib and not have to actually grab the sculpture. Right. Sadly, the Port of Oakland wasn't equipped to handle this oversized, unique kind of product. So those cribs were set on trucks and driven down to Long Beach. And then each was rolled into the belly of a brand new barge down through the Panama Canal. From what I understand, once they got on the trucks and were heading for the reserve, the tiniest little town just outside the reserve, people actually had to come out and stand up on the sculptures on trucks with brooms to hold the power lines up so the trucks could drive underneath it. So these towns really have never seen anything quite that big coming through.
Where else could a person go, let's say in the Bay Area, to see some of your work right now?
I have 2 pieces at the Uptown Art Park at the moment, which is 19th and Telegraph next to the Fox Theater. Mm-hmm. I have a couple at Lake Merritt in the Botanical Gardens. Those were for the Autumn Lights Festival 2 years ago, and they just kind of stayed there, which is great. People still enjoy them.
Autumn Lights.
Right.
I don't know what that is. And I should know what it is.
You should. It is one of Oakland's best annual events. It happens at the Gardens at Lake Merritt. I believe it's the second weekend of October.
The Gardens are close to... or they're on the north side of the lake. Is that right?
North. I believe... I'm a little directionally challenged. I believe it's north. It's just beyond Fairyland.
Okay.
So if Fairyland is on the right, the Gardens are past the lawn bowling fields on the left.
All right, there you go.
So this is their annual fundraiser. Tickets are sold. I think they've extended it to 3 nights now. And the concept there is to really celebrate the gardens. And so it's curated with art that is illuminated or has some interaction with light and the gardens, the plants. Mm. So I remember the first year I went, someone had very simply inserted one single LED inside of each of the giant trumpet flowers on this massive shrub. And I was instantly transported into, you know, Hobbit land or fairyland. It was gorgeous. And so a lot of folks do things with, candlelight, wearing garments that are illuminated. The guests are encouraged to come in their own illuminated garb, which it makes the whole event interactive. Everybody is an art piece.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful event. It's one of Oakland's best, as I said, and it's getting bigger and better every year. They got a tremendous amount of art set up last year.
Huh. Remind me that it's...
second weekend, I believe, in October.
Okay.
Yep.
I will keep an eye out for it. And of course, there you have work at American Steel Studios that is prominently displayed, quite visible to anyone who walks up there. Are visitors welcome?
Visitors are. Visitors show up unexpectedly all the time. People are just intrigued and curious about what happens there. And we have people who are just passing through on vacation that end up wandering into the building, which is pretty impressive, I think. It's a pretty scary, massive industrial warehouse. And you got these families with little kids coming in to see what's happening in here. And it happens frequently enough where I've actually decided to have a monthly tour on the second Saturday of every month.
So the next one of those coming up would be...
that would be April...
11th. And it's at, for people who might want to pop over and not worry so much about the scheduled tour on Second Saturday, it's on Mandela Parkway in West Oakland, just south of Grand Avenue. Is
yes.
that right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Karen, we were talking about your art, large-scale metal sculptures. I asked you about some of the materials that you, and how this happens, how you make this stuff, and you talked about parts of old bridges. And I know you have been involved somehow with getting your hands on and helping other people get their hands on the steel from the old eastern span of the Bay Bridge that's coming down. How did that start? How did this effort to get that steel into the hands of artists come about?
Interestingly, I think it was two different things kind of happening at once. There was a designation for a park at the touchdown of the Bay Bridge on the east side, and I was involved with a group of people sort of discussing what that space could be. When I went to the first presentation, I think Caltrans and a few other agencies put together, I was looking at concepts that included a dog park, a shopping mall, things that just really were not unique to us in the Bay Area. And I felt I was one of many, many people that felt we could add a lot more value to that space. It started off as a 200-acre space owned, I believe, by 9 different agencies, including the Port, City of Oakland, a lot of different big, heavy
yeah.
agencies.
Yeah.
So trying to influence and inspire that process was something I certainly didn't do on my own and really didn't even know how to do. So that's where a lot of folks kind of came together and batted around ideas and looked at concepts that we could sort of share with them. It occurred to me, you know, this park was going to be possible because of the new bridge having a different area where it touches down. So I started pondering what was going to happen to the old bridge. And as you mentioned, I do make art out of old things. And so I started realizing there's a lot of history encapsulated in that bridge. And there are many, many communities that were connected by that bridge over many years. Mm-hmm. So I just got inspired to try to keep some of that here. Specifically for Oakland, I'm always looking for ways where Oakland can get a little more Oakland pride.
So you thought, here's an opportunity, a big metal bridge.
Yeah, and I kind of started calling it like our bridge. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the East Bay's bridge. It's Oakland's bridge. And for me, there was a lot of pride in that mix, along with the inspiration and the concept of reusing this historic steel. I think I would say this is one of the scariest things I've ever done. Again, working with a small group of bandits, as it were.
What makes it scary?
This is just yet another time where I kind of stepped into something I really had no training in doing. And therefore, I didn't know the process, didn't know the protocol, didn't know the language.
Yeah.
The learning curve was huge for me. And I've never done a Save the Something campaign, right? I just had to really dig deep down inside and find this strength and organization and vision and somehow kind of share my enthusiasm with people who could influence other people and share that enthusiasm with others. And it's actually quite a difficult thing to do. People are busy. Taking on new projects for people or asking them to support something is something I find I do a lot, and I try to really restrain like how many times I ask for help or support or whatever it is. But I also realized that talking with Caltrans was something that was going to be a challenge because I'm a visual artist and they're engineers and administrators and managers, and I was very challenged about how to really get the idea of what's possible out in a place where we could look at it and kind of talk about it and see where we might get it to go. So I reached out to the community, the art community, and asked folks to just submit some concept drawings, and wow, what people turned in, it was just amazing. Exciting designs, all very big, all very industrial, very beautiful. Some are very elegant. And with that, with those drawings, I was able to have something to share with these agencies, the decision makers, to say, here's what we could have in our landscape in the future.
So now where are we with this process?
Well, the proposal was submitted. Caltrans and the other agencies that were kind of involved in this really somehow came around to acknowledge that there was some merit to the idea and there was some value in keeping some of our history here. So what then is the question. So very simply, establishing criteria for how the steel can be used. So it won't be someone's personal fire pit or barbecue pit for their backyard. It's got to be a public installation. It should have some retain visual flavor of the bridge, have some resonance with the history and the industrial kind of quality of the bridge itself. But otherwise, the criteria is not yet defined any further than that.
How much steel are we talking here? I mean, I don't know what the right quantity is. You could tell me we measure steel in cords like wood, and I'd probably believe you. But how much steel?
I think the initial ask was for 600 tons. It's really not as much as you think. I'm thinking about, you know, the division of that. How many pieces could we get? You know, and not all of them need to be massive. Not all of them need to be 100% Bay Bridge steel. Yeah. So in other words, there could be a sculptural piece that just has one beam of the bridge included in it, and it's very definitely noted as part of the bridge. It's all a, you know, part of the visual representation of the bridge. So 600 tons, you know, figure how far you can spread that around the Bay Area. It's not really that much. So factoring in the cost of dealing with the steel and that sort of thing is kind of where the numbers are going to ultimately be determined.
Where does the money come for making this project happen? I mean, is Caltrans saying we will help you make this happen? Is, you know, how does that work?
I actually am not part of that conversation.
Okay. You seem delighted to not be part of that conversation.
I am very delighted to not be part of that conversation. I'm equally delighted that the Oakland Museum of California will be managing the process from this point forward. And if you go to their website, you'll see there's a page now there for the bridge project for Bay Bridge Steel. And that's where you can see updates and get more details.
But it's going to be a while before that all comes down.
I would expect it's about at minimum a year, possibly. And in fact, the public art process is really not very quick.
So you and other artists are doing what I guess you can call industrial arts. Is that a thing? Is that a term?
It has become a term, in fact, yes.
All right. And I know that kind of down the road from you is the Crucible, where other artists are working and where they teach classes. In fact, my previous show interviewing an architect who takes blacksmithing classes at the Crucible. It seems like, though, kind of there is this cluster, this industrial arts cluster in West Oakland. Who else is there working, doing similar kinds of work or things that might fall under that industrial arts umbrella around there?
There are quite a few of us, actually. A lot of the nondescript warehouse faces that you see have a lot of industry and activity happening behind the doors. So past the Crucible is Bruce Beasley's Sculpture Park and Studio Space. Bruce Beasley is a prolific artist. He has work installed around the world and in our City Hall Plaza in Oakland as well. And he's been there. He's one of the first pioneers of making art in West Oakland. And he was doing it long before they even had streetlights or curbstones. There was really very paltry infrastructure for the people of West Oakland. It was very much a working class when there was a lot of industry in that area. And he became quite a, I guess I would say, a community leader in a lot of ways, because he tackled a lot of those issues and he got a lot of equity for West Oakland, have their infrastructure brought up to be on par with the rest of Oakland. He's campaigned heavily for lots of betterment over his years there, and has really made some exquisite impacts.
So who else is around? What else is happening up and down that corridor, this sort of cluster that you've been a part of?
So a couple of blocks away from Bruce's space is the Lost and Foundry. And that houses about, I would say, half a dozen to 10 artists. They're not working consistently on a huge scale. They've done some big projects previously. There's a lot of really interesting art that happens there. I would call it industrial, but it's of a smaller nature. Nemo Gould is one of the artists there. He's brilliant at repurposing things such as typewriters and parts and pieces of just about anything. There's a another group called Five Ton Crane, of which Sean Orlando is part of. He's done a lot of large scale art as well as, you know, some of his own personal works. Up the road from there is St. Louis Studios. That's on the other side of West Grand. I don't want to say a modest size warehouse because it makes me sound like a size queen, but it is a warehouse. And so there's a number of artists that work. They're doing industrial art, but they're also doing some of the more high-tech things, I guess. I don't know if I would say 3D printing, things of that nature. So combining kind of the technology and the industry together in some of the work that happens there.
And it still seems to me that the art scene in Oakland generally is extraordinarily vibrant, but it is getting harder to just stay put in the Bay Area and keep your hold on a space if you don't own it. Have you seen the search for space change?
I think people are starting to go wide. In other words, Vallejo is starting to develop their own art space and public art areas. The challenge with Oakland is that securing an art space is one thing, but you also need to be able to afford to live nearby. Mm-hmm. So it's two sides of that need to work. For me, I've fallen in love with Oakland. I don't want to have to leave Oakland, and I think that's kind of perhaps the impetus behind a lot of what I do. I do want to stay put. Mm-hmm. And find folks are becoming more resourceful with what they can produce in a smaller space. In other words, how thrifty can you be? One really great benefit of American steel is because we have such high ceilings, you can always go up. So you can minimize your footprint, but go vertical. Mm. People are sharing space more. There's more shared tools, which also gives birth to great partnerships and collaboration. So there's benefit to that as well.
As people have become more interested in West Oakland, working there, living there, building there, it seems like that's the kind of thing that might make it hard for artists to stay put. And you said very clearly you want to stay put. That desire to stay put has gotten you involved in conversations around local politics and planning. I know that you have been involved, but I don't really know what form that has taken. So why don't you tell me about how you found your way into local politics?
I think I fell. I fell right in. Well, actually, I don't really think of it as getting involved in local politics so much as I think it is taking an interest in my community and trying to really shape and support my neighborhood to better support the neighbors. In other words, there are a few ways that we can make simple changes that will make things better for all of us as residents, as businesses. We have a tremendous problem with graffiti, for example. It's pretty depressing to come to work every day and see that someone's lifted their leg on your building again. Mm. And that does a lot to kind of take morale down. So how do you respond to that? You basically just start talking to people and see what's possible, what other options are there, what other ideas do people have about how to respond to these challenges, and how can we circumvent some other issues. We have railroad rights of way that have been neglected for decades. They can knock the axle out of your car. Yeah. So although they've just repaved a long stretch of Peralta Street, there's still this dilapidated old railroad track running through it. You've got to slow way down again. These guys are supposed to be responsible for that property, even though it's a small 2-foot, 4-foot wide slip through a street.
You mean the railroad?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, how do we get these guys to be accountable and take care of their property that is in our neighborhood? So a lot of what I've done, I would say, kind of was ignited by what was the West Oakland specific plan. And this was, I think, started in 2011. And essentially is City of Oakland got a federal grant to do what is essentially a marketing campaign for West Oakland. West Oakland is a huge district. It's the largest in Oakland, includes Jack London Square all the way up San Pablo Corridor. And through this study with a panel of architects, economic specialists, and so forth, querying where do we want West Oakland to be? What do we want it to be like? How do we want the population to be? What type of activities do we want to have happen there? And when I accidentally showed up at this first meeting that I'd learned about, I saw that they were sort of sketching over any parcel of land that they deemed underutilized, blighted, or abandoned. Oh. They were sketching, the architects and planners were sketching two-story office buildings with rooftop parking. And it just didn't feel right. That wasn't West Oakland. That is a suburban corporate office park. That's not what West Oakland is. West Oakland's roots have a lot of really amazing jazz and blues, a long line of creative art, visual, as well as music. And the corporate suburban office park is not, it's just not part of that fabric. So after this first presentation, I walked up to one of the consultants and I asked, who on your panel is in charge of community art and culture? Mm. And she thought for a moment, she said, well, actually no one. And I said, that's really apparent to me because this is not a neighborhood I would want to live in. This is not a neighborhood that has any qualities that would draw me to it, yeah. what you're sketching out here. So after that meeting, I again reached out to people and asked for their support to come to these meetings. I think there were over 110 of them, to just show up and share your opinion, share your view. Let us know what do you need to be here to do the work that you do? What would better support you as a resident here? We need grocery stores. We need, you know, some welding supply store would be great for me. Mm, yeah. But, you know, instead of converting more of our schools into condos, let's make better schools. So over these years, I got a lot of folks probably deeply annoyed with me by constantly asking them to either show up or speak up or sign something or just kind of be involved and respond to things, have an opinion. Let me hear how this sounds to you.
Yeah. You were implementing the classic squeaky wheel model of local political engagement.
It's fabulously popular. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great way to make friends.
Yeah. So you, that was over the course of the West Oakland Specific Plan process, mm-hmm. which I guess wrapped up last year?
Summer.
Last
mm-hmm.
summer, yeah. What now? I mean, what happens to your engagement, to the engagement that you and others that you help foster after that plan and in the future?
Well, I don't really know because I've never done this before. I made a presentation Friday night and spoke at length about the specific plan and other challenges that I was working on. And someone from the audience handed me his card. I guess he's a planner, developer, fundraiser, sounds like a great person. He said, do you need help with this? And I said, I need help with everything. Yeah. Like, so hand me as many cards as you want. So, you know, I think through conversation with people who actually do this for as a career, yeah. I'm going to learn a lot more and see how I can stay involved and kind of just try to keep nudging things in ways that I think make sense.
You asked other members of the community, people who are there now, what do you need to support your life, to stay put, to make this neighborhood better for you? What were some of the answers that you got, other than grocery store and welding mm-hmm. supply?
Well, sadly, the answer that I got a lot, which I don't like and I'm not really happy to settle with, is that artists historically have to leave spaces. They have to leave the neighborhoods they've moved into because gentrification happens. So a lot of folks that I spoke with in my own art community really don't expect to be able to stay put, and they're not convinced that their participation or engagement in any of these processes is ever going to make a difference. Artists generally are not very well considered in terms of a local economy. Mm. And understandable. You know, last couple of years, I had some city council house parties, people running for city council for my district at American Steel, as well as mayoral candidates more recently. And my goal with that really is, I think a lot of times politicians think of artists as that weird cousin that you have to talk to at Thanksgiving dinner once a year and you don't really know what to say. Like, mm-hmm. they acknowledge that we exist. They kind of sort of maybe understand what we do, but they really don't know much beyond that. And fair enough. A lot of us do some pretty wacky things. A lot of us use giant tools that, you know, most folks would never even think about owning. I don't think it's clear about what the economy of arts can do as far as job creation for a city. So by having these candidates come into American Steel and have conversations with our tenants, I think allowed the door to open for a two-way dialogue. Instead of just having to pretend or assume they understood what we did and needed, we could actually engage with people and let them know, here, not only here's what we need, but here's what we can do. Hmm. Here's what we can contribute to the landscape of Oakland. Here's what we can contribute by way of classes, internships, neighborhood beautification projects. There's an awful lot of skills that we have, and if we put them together and get a little organization behind us, we can do amazing things.
You had a kind of inaugural party for the new mayor. That doesn't happen by accident. How did that come about?
Libby Schaff asked, and we said, okay. Yeah. So I think through the course of her campaign on many occasions, the arts and the maker community of Oakland just kept kind of winding its way through, you know, her awareness. I couldn't be more excited. It's great to be acknowledged on that level, and to have a party for your mayor in your very own industrial warehouse is just a ridiculous dream, you know? Not what I ever thought of having, but once it started coming together, it seemed to make a lot of sense to me. Mm. I would like more crossover rather than less.
Yeah. What have your goals been, and you know, as you've been engaged in local conversations about planning and development and how to make the neighborhood better, what are your goals as that sort of conversation, whatever form that takes in the future?
I think I frame each conversation or each endeavor, whatever it is, the ultimate goal is how can this keep our creative community employed and engaged? And kind of through that lens, I think it really informs a lot of what I do and how I do things, who I might reach out to get in touch with or bounce ideas around with. And if the things that I'm kind of tackling have that goal kind of built into the end of it, I can't imagine it being the wrong thing to aim for. I would love to see more job creation beyond the art community. There's a tremendous amount of industry that could be happening. I mean, Oakland has off the hook number of amazing restaurants. There's a lot of culinary, food prep, things of that sort happening there. And so the demand should be quite great for jobs in Oakland. And I think if we can diversify that beyond just the kitchen and into more of the maker community and the artistic community, then there could be a tremendous economic base for a lot of people.
That's pretty broad kind of citywide stuff. What about West Oakland itself, the neighborhood? You know, what would you like to see happening? You talked about needing a grocery store, sure, but what would you like to see, happening in and happen to the neighborhood over the next, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, I think one thing that would start things off in a really great direction, we have a lot of antiquated warehouses. These are spaces that can't be used because their infrastructure is just so outdated, whether it's electrical systems or lack of a sprinkler system or broken, you know, doors, things of that sort. So a lot of a few of the folks that I've spoke to who own these buildings are wondering why people aren't wanting to move in. And what I've heard the response in most cases be is that if you want to move in a Superfly industrial kitchen that's cooking up all the food that's being sold at, you know, whatever supermarket, they need to meet different codes these days than they did before. So I would like to see folks reinvest in West Oakland. The folks who have investments there, rather than land banking and just waiting for the tides to change so they can sell off this property for who knows what, actually get it to a state where it's usable. There are a lot of people that are looking for spaces, but they're not able to find them there because the warehouses are not supporting that industry.
Do we need to worry about American Steel Studios?
I'm working hard to make sure we don't have to. I've had a lot of conversations, a lot of ideas, a lot of folks approach me with ideas. So there's a lot of interest in the city of Oakland and in our community to have Amsteel stay put.
You talked about not having training for negotiating with a bunch of agencies to get steel from bridges being torn down. Nobody ever trained you to get involved in local conversations around development. And I'm guessing you probably also didn't have training in how to manage a 6-acre industrial space.
None at all.
You sort of learned your way into all of these things out of necessity. What do you think the next thing you're going to have to learn how to do is?
I hope the next thing I have to learn is to let go a bit. And in order to do that, I need to take a lot of what I'm doing and kind of share it with others, get other people involved, have them pick up something they might be interested in and kind of bring it along. The last couple of years have been deeply exhausting for me. And the amount of time I get to spend making art has diminished dramatically. So I need to get back to the place. I mean, I feel like I've just created the world's most amazing studio space that I don't get to use. And trying to squeeze hours in after at night after working all day is not working. The energy shift is huge. So I think the next thing I need, I want to learn to do is get my work-life balance back and get some art made and really have the art community of West Oakland come together to really just drive home some things that we've all been kind of pining for.
We've talked a little bit along the way about your art and how kind of how your practice and interest have evolved over time. And like I said earlier, I know you as the person who has made the big steel sculptures. Tell me what you have tried to kind of capture and express in your sculpture over the years.
I think a very consistent theme or ingredient for me is nature. I have a great reverence for nature, and it influences a lot of who I am and what I do. Simply, you know, being sensitive to daylight, when the days get shorter in the winter, I get a little glum. So having kind of a good rapport with nature, I think, is one thing I try to do. As a kid, I was just constantly running around, hiking, swimming, just really active outdoors. And so I kind of thought of nature as my playground and my friend. I'm growing more and more devastated about our state of affairs with our environment, with how we just disregard for our planet. And I know that there's not much I can do to change that personally. I, you know, try to improve my own practices and that sort of thing. But I think a lot of that has wound up playing a part in the scale of the nature pieces that I sculpt. In other words, nature becomes much bigger than the human. So imagine a leaf that you can sit in. Imagine a 20-foot tall dandelion. And just kind of maybe giving nature the size or importance that I think it deserves. And again, part of that too, in most cases, involves using reclaimed materials. The process of recycling is quite energy heavy. First, we're shipping it across an ocean, and they're melting it down and sending it back to us. There's a lot of energy involved in making steel. So I think it's just become second nature to me to work with salvage materials. And I recall back when I was at RISD, I did a huge series of portraits.
RISD, Rhode Island School of Design.
A long series of portraits of shoes. And these weren't new shoes. These were really old shoes, shoes that someone had worn for years. And the shoes, kind of like dogs, reflect the personality or look like their owners. These shoes all had really unique personalities and characteristics. And I saw beauty in these old shoes. And so I did a lot of portraits of them, and for no real reason, just to kind of acknowledge and celebrate them. So I guess I have a bit of a reverence for history and the origin of things, and that inspires a lot of what I do as well. So moving forward, as I said, I'm trying to work on a smaller scale. I think I need to shift gears a bit and kind of shake some things off and redirect. And it's not something I'm going to force. It's something I'm going to just let happen. I'm really curious to see where that takes me. I do have a lot of ideas emerging where I'm creating art that I want people to engage in. I want them to sit inside of and kind of feel a part of. It's important to me that that connection happens.
Have you done a lot of work that you would describe as interactive?
I would say conceptually interactive. I would say engaging or interactive in that you can climb into and around and sit on them or under them. It's not quite a playful toy piece of art, but I think that the statement that my art generally is making is something that's going to make someone scratch their brain a little bit and think about things is what I hope.
You talked about trying to move more toward, well, somewhat smaller scale. You challenged yourself to do something you could fit in the back of your small pickup truck. Is that, you're kind of still moving toward smaller things, but still big enough that a person could sit on it kind of stuff. So you're not going to start making jewelry size pieces.
Nothing thimble size, yeah. I don't imagine.
Okay.
For now.
Who do you like right now? I always like to ask people sort of whose work are you excited about, or is there someone you think that whose work is really great and should be getting a little more attention, a show we should go check out, that sort of thing. Who do you like? What do you like?
Wow, that's a huge question. And that changes a lot for me pretty frequently, yeah. But I would encourage folks to remain enthusiastic about the Oakland Art Murmur, which has grown immensely. And it's actually grown to include American Steel Studios. So I'm a fan of a lot of the work made at American Steel, not just because it's from American Steel.
Right.
But yeah, it's the list is long. And that's because I have a great regard for people who are doing things that I don't know how to do. And that means there's a lot. So whether it's, some fashion design, which isn't something I generally think about as a metal worker, I just want to make sure I'm burn-proof. I don't really consider what I look like too much. But some people, I see these creations, and it's just amazing that people think about that stuff. It's remarkable to me. So I guess as far as shows, I regret to say that I don't often, I just don't get out enough.
Yeah.
The number of shows I've gone to is, in the last couple of years, has gotten quite small. And I do need to replenish my pool of inspiration. I think at least once a year I try to get down to the Rodin Sculpture Park at Stanford, which is, if you haven't been, it's free, it's open to the public, and it's just, it's very humbling, and it kind of recenters me in a way. A great body of work all in one amazing place.
Clearly Rodin important to you. Who else do you kind of look to for inspiration, or have you looked to?
Well, I think probably on my top 10 list would be Da Vinci, because of the marriage of art and science, and his just undying desire to conquer the unknown and figure things out and experiment and explore. That's really important for an artist, I think, to remain curious and prod themselves to try new things and challenge themselves.
You seem to not have any trouble doing that.
Challenge, I think, follows me. I don't know. I don't know that I look for it.
Well, have you ever been tempted to go and work in, sculpt in other media?
I have.
Oh.
I actually, ironically, did study fashion design for a while.
Okay.
And so I was working with fabric and sewing and things, and I realized the field was just really competitive, and I wasn't, and it wasn't something that would probably work for me. But moving from the two-dimensional paintings and drawings, I began building and sculpting with a lot of found objects. And I remember an interesting period of time where I just was really deeply amused about putting doorknobs on things. So things that are not doors, things that don't open, things that people should know aren't really going to yield anything, and yet they still reach out and grab the doorknob.
Give me an example.
A tree, a rock, things that, but people try it. They just do. People are curious. I love getting, being able to engage someone in that way where you're making their brain go a little sideways is really kind of fun. And I think art should be fun. The fountain, Duchamp's fountain, I think is probably one of my favorite pieces of all time. It is a powerful mechanism to really cause people to just reexamine their world and the things that are in it and how they interact with those things. Beautiful.
You don't see yourself moving away from metal anytime soon, though, right now.
I have an awful lot in stock, so yeah, not anytime soon.
Got a piece of a bridge headed your way.
Yeah. No, I don't think I'll ever really be entirely finished with metal.
Yeah.
But I do, when you're asking about what I see moving forward, I do want to keep some large-scale work going, but also kind of keep some smaller works going simultaneously. And by that, I mean some of the bigger pieces that I've worked on have taken many, many, many months. And I don't often get to enjoy that sense of putting my tools away and dusting off my hands and having completed a project. Yeah. So I think some closure and completion and that sort of thing is good for smaller projects.
If I wanted to get a good sense of what you were working on now, how could I come and take a look at your studio?
You could come to our next Art Murmur. Oakland Art Murmur happens at American Steel on the first Friday of each month. It's open to the public from 6 to 9.
6 to 9, okay. This, I think, spells the end of our time together. Karen, thank you. Yes, indeed. Many thanks to Karen Cusolito for talking with me this week. You can check out her work at karecuso.com. And you can find out more about American Steel Studios at, logically enough, americansteelstudios.com. I want to clarify one thing. American Steel isn't open to the public just at will. So don't wander in off the street like, I'm here to look directly at a welding torch. That will not go well. Check out their website. Again, that's americansteelstudios.com. Look at their event calendar to find a time when visitors are welcome. It's worth the trip. You know what is open to the public at all times, though? That's tespodcast.com. It's the website for this podcast. You can subscribe, grab old episodes, find out more about the people I've talked to. It's free. I make it for you. It's at tespodcast.com. All right, it's that time. This has been The Eastern Shore. I have been and continue to be Brock Winstead. Thank you for listening. We'll do it again next week. Listening to The Eastern Shore on BFF.FM, best frequencies forever. Please remember that we have a Kickstarter going on, very exciting stuff happening. 3 days left to help support BFF.FM's push to build a Studio B. That's at BFF.FM/Kickstarter. Coming up in about 30 seconds, San Francisco people.
Sandra Kostoulis, and today you'll hear my story on San Francisco people.